Is that the ABA?
A little bit. Yeah, I did. I did two readings there. There's some cords here, so that's about as best I can scoot.
Move this over.
Yeah, that's fine. If you're going to have me read, then my voice changes and the volume changes when I read.
Well, we can. I won't have you read very much because the broadcast is so short. By the time I take the tape and I edit it and make it into a daily feature on books, you know, I don't have a lot of time for the reading, but some of them are so, some of your stories are so small and so jewel-like that they would lend itself to some of that, I think.
Yeah.
But I'd never been to the ABA myself. I thought it was really good to look at that auditorium and see those thousands and thousands of booths of books.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
It's the second one I've been to when I was there. I guess I've been more impressed by the whole tour since this was City 18, my 19th city tour. And I've been, what I think has impressed me is all the booksellers and the people involved in the book business that love books. The people who aren't writers that love reading books, the people that I'm signing books for that just have restored my faith in humanity. You know, just young people, kids, high school students that I love the stories. And, you know, even the author escorts that love reading my stories or any story, any good story. The fact that there's a public out there that is reading books has been so heartening to me. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that because I've been kind of discouraged about it myself.
I had two, I have to say, before this tour began. But it's been lovely meeting the children and the high school students and especially the teachers that have been coming up to me and asking me to sign their books, family members buying books for their cousins, for their mothers, for their sisters, brothers. That's been wonderful.
But you understand that literary celebrity is somewhat different from popular celebrity. I was talking to E.L. Doctorow a little while ago. He was telling me that he can walk down the street, any street in New York City, completely anonymously. Nobody recognizes him. And even if someone did recognize him, they've never read the book. they may have heard of him from someplace, or they may have seen the motion picture Ragtime.
Yeah.
But literary celebrity is that which is shared by a relatively small group of people. And the statistics are frightening. I read somewhere that the average adult buys only one... here's the way it works. 1% of the adult population will buy a single hardcover book in a year.
Well, that doesn't mean, though, that they don't like stories or they don't like being read to or that they wouldn't enjoy the stories, because I read to a lot of people that can't afford to buy my books, and that's quite all right. That's why I'm so glad that someone in a position of power like teachers can buy my books and read them to the students, and the students will remember it and enjoy it. Or children who, of course, don't have the money or means or ways to get to a bookstore. They love the stories, and it doesn't matter to me, and I shouldn't say this because roundabouts won't like it, but it's very important to me that the stories go out there to reach people and empower them in the way that stories used to empower people, I guess, when we were used to listening to stories, so they can teach us and give us routes and make us feel good. You know, that's important for me. It's not real important that people buy it as much as that they hear the stories.
Well, it's a wonderful thing to say, and you're right. I think the Random House would say, "Hey, wait a minute, because who's going to finance the author,
the tour?" But look at that. The book's already in reprint. It's selling very, very well. Even if you know, the people that I want it to reach can't afford to buy the book, there are enough people who can afford to buy it that are buying it. Teachers, like as I said. All kinds of people from all different classes and all different colors, and that makes me happy.
What do you think about this publishing house that has given Ivana Trump $5 million to write three books as soon as they find an author to write the books for Ivana?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I don't know very much about Ivana Trump. I know nothing about the Trumps, but, you know, that's okay. It's mutual. They don't know anything about me. That's not my world. And, you know, I'm very happy that she can do that. And, that, you know, she's taking care of her end of it. But, You know, I really don't have an opinion about Ivana Trump, and I can't understand why anyone would be interested in her life. I'm certainly not.
I agree. I mean, I'm baffled by it, which is also why I'm baffled that a publisher would give a woman who is not a writer X millions of dollars to write three books. While other people are struggling. I talk to writers, I've talked to hundreds and hundreds of writers over the years. Some you've never heard of. Some have been very successful. But almost every one of them struggles to become a writer. And all of a sudden, some money is given to a person who is not a writer, and in fact, they're going to have to hire a writer to actually physically do the work for her, even though it's going to come out under her name. I mean, to me, I don't think that's what publishing is for. Or maybe it is. Maybe the bottom line for some of these publishing houses is exactly that. Get a book that's going
to
sell.
Well, maybe they've got to sell those books, those big blockbuster sellers, so that they can finance books that are of much more literary merit. You know, precisely because only 1% of the population purchases books. And, you know, if they have to sell a book, you know, and to Ivana Trump and sell her story simply so it can pay the majority of the bills. On the other hand, I think the way of balancing it is the books of merit that they do publish that perhaps aren't going to be those mega blockbusters.
Well, let's talk about you and talk about your work. I've read both of these books. They're beautifully written, and I think, as I mentioned before, they strike me as jewel-like, little gems flowing through the pages.
That's nice. Thank you.
The House on Mango Street, that has the feeling of autobiography to it. Set in Chicago, is it where you are from?
Yeah, it's set in Chicago, but it's not an autobiography. The setting is autobiographical, and the neighborhood is autobiographical, but it's not really my story. It's a composite of stories from my students when I was teaching high school dropouts. And it's a composite of several people's stories put together into the life of the persona who is, you know, who is a young 12-year-old, 13, mid thereabouts. That's her age. But that's the question I get asked the most, is this your story? Is this a true story? People just generally assume it is my story because I've taken autobiographical elements. But like any fiction writer, you use a foundation that's based on reality, and then you create a collage, you know, with the eyes of one person and mouth of someone else and the hands of somebody else, and you put it all together and you create this character.
Well, one thing that struck me in reading both The House on Mango Street and your new book, Woman Hollering Creek, is that childhood is really tough. It leaves an indelible mark on people because childhood is that period in which one discovers. And when you discover something for the first time, you usually remember it. And the thing that also struck me is that it's tough, it's hard.
Yeah, I think children are the most powerless people on the planet. And I'm always writing about people that are disempowered or who are ignored or usually who are not given a voice. But I'm especially attracted to children, and I'm always looking at them and writing about them because, you know, there are so many hurtful things that happen to them, things that happen to us as in the magnitude of things that would happen to us as adults. But they're little children, and they don't know, have any way to complain or articulate or scream or yell for help. So I guess that's why I'm always fascinated by the dilemmas of children.
Yes, you and I are adults, and we probably have traumas every day in our life.
Yeah.
You know, whether we have to deal with a rude ticket agent at an airport, or a taxi driver, or a close friend who suddenly becomes not a close friend. We are adults, and we have these pains and dilemmas, but here we have a child, and it seems to us as adults, from the perspective of being an adult, this is not very important. But here's a child who wants to take her lunch to the canteen and eat it, and is met by nuns who say, in effect, they can. I mean, a traumatic thing that we would think, well,
a little tiny thing that seems so silly to an adult is such a major disaster to mm-hmm. a child. You know, and I remember when I was a child, you know, you would, horrible things would happen to you that would stay with you till your dying day, probably. And you'd come home and you had no words in which to talk about it. You were so ashamed that you kept it secret in your heart. And your mother would say, well, did you have a good day? And you'd say, yes, of course you'd have a horrible day. It was the worst day of your life. But you couldn't mention about those little private humiliations that had happened to you. And your mother, you know, as much as she loved you and wanted to protect you, she couldn't protect you from the world that sometimes didn't love you. You know, it was sad.
Yeah, I remember when I was in the second grade at Oral M. Roberts Elementary School in Houston, Texas. My mother dropped me off to school, and I forgot my lunch. I left it in the car. My mother drove off, and I suddenly realized that I was without my lunch, and I began to cry, and people said, what's wrong with Don? Mm-hmm. And, he left his lunch at home.
I was so miserable. How could you make anyone understand?
That's right. See, I wouldn't have minded leaving the lunch at home so much, except that at lunchtime, everybody had to eat in the same room at the same time. And I would have been the only kid without a lunch.
Oh, that's right. Oh,
yeah,
that's
so
right.
I could have gone without the lunch, but I could not go with the humiliation of not having the lunch.
It's so hard to explain that. You know, when you're crying, it isn't that you're crying about the lunch. It's so hard to explain to big people. I remember when I was little having these tremendous afternoons when you would just cry and cry and cry. And, of course, the adults ignore you because they don't understand the real reason why you're crying. And you can't explain it. You can, but 20 years later. That's the sad thing about it.
Yeah, it's not easy to articulate the hurt and the humiliation when you're a child.
Yes, exactly.
And many adults can't do it either.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, I really feel like the character in one of the stories that says she's 11 on the outside, but inside she's also 10 and 9 and 8 and 7 and 6 and 5 and 4 and 3 and 2 and 1, because the way we grow old is kind of like a tree trunk. All the rings, one inside the other. And I feel that way. You know, I'm 36 on the outside, but inside I'm also 11, and I'm 27, and I'm 14 and 5. And it's really easy for me to write from that perspective of all the characters that I write about, because I don't forget what it felt like. You know, if I see someone walking down the street crying who's 5 and going through a terrible afternoon, I remember what that was like. I don't think as artists that we let those memories go. They're inside us.
Yeah, and there's another component to that. You are at the age of 10 or 11, as you indicate, the sum total of your entire years.
That's right.
And I look upon my childhood, each year, my childhood, high school, college, and so forth, as really the last year of my life. I don't think of really that much. I mean, people say, look, you ought to put your money into a savings account and you got to think about your retirement. But even today, I think about what I'm doing today.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that the traumas I have today are identical to the traumas I had at 10.
Yes.
Because that was the sum total of my life at 10,
That's right.
It is at the age of 50.
That's
so
right.
You could correct me on this, but I am sure that you probably feel the same way. I don't think I'm any different today at my age than I was when I was 10 or 11.
Yeah.
I mean, I have more experience. Mm-hmm. I know how to take an airplane across the country, and I can write a check, and I can read a book and handle myself as an adult in ways that I couldn't as a child, but
I think you're right, and I think that's the thing that is so fascinating for me when I see children, because they've got such little bodies, but they have all of the spirit that they'll have as adults, and all of the emotions, the shame and the fears and the pride of adults in a little tiny body, and none of the ways to defend themselves that an adult would. And I guess that's why I'm always drawn to them. My eye and my ear is always drawn to things that children do or say. That's why I guess I read about them.
Now, Sandra, you come from a Mexican-American family in Chicago. Tell me what your childhood was like.
Well, I'm an only daughter in a family that grew up out of circumstance in a working class neighborhood, but who always thought they were better than the circumstances. I guess that's why I'm such the rare exception that I am, and that I've been able to be so successful. You know, I came from a family that always thought you know, well, we may be living in this neighborhood, but it's only temporary, so don't go hanging around on the corner now, or you've got to study, or, you know, always we're pushing. They were always pushing us to be better than our surroundings, and even though the schools we went to were not very good, and the teachers didn't treat us as if we were anything special. Actually, they treated us as if we were nothing, as if we were destined to be nothing.
Yes. You're not too easy on the
novels. No, because they really turned me off to spirituality. It's only recently with the liberation theology movement that I've regained some faith in organized religion. But when I was growing up, the sisters were the most unchristian women I had met, because they were very mean to the poor children in the school, and of course by poor that meant the Mexican kids in the schools. But we didn't know that. We didn't know why they didn't love us. But you know, as a child, you know when someone doesn't love you. You don't know why they don't love you, but you try very hard to make them love you, even though you can't understand why they don't. And, you know, that even though we weren't loved at school, our mother and father loved us a great deal. And they had such great faith and love in us that even though we were buffeted by, you know, circumstances beyond their control, we had that core of self-esteem that our mother and father had given us. And even though it would take a lot of years for me to unbury myself from the pain that one goes through growing up in neighborhoods like the ones I went to, essentially that core was there. And I think that's why I've been able to survive, you know, the neighborhoods I grew up in, to survive the institutions that I went through.
I'm surprised. I didn't realize there was a Mexican community, I guess, in Chicago,
huge.
But I guess there must be everywhere.
Oh, my
when
God.
I think about it.
We are everywhere and we're taking over. Yes. It is very big. There's more of a Mexicano population in Chicago, in the greater Chicago area, than there are in the entire state of New Mexico. So it's a huge population of Mexicans, Mexican-Americans. And it has been that way for quite a long time, because, you know, Chicago was a railroad center, and a lot of the Mexicans came in search of jobs and came up through the railroad, as my grandfather did during the Mexican Revolution. So you have cities where there's railroads, where a great many, you know, migratory patterns of people of color came up north, and that includes the Mexican people through cities like Flagstaff, Kansas City, Chicago.
You're living in San Antonio now.
I live in San Antonio when I can. You know, I don't make my living as a writer, and I certainly do not make my living in Texas. I can't get a job in Texas, so I farm myself out as a kind of migrant professor, and I teach creative writing as a guest at different universities. I just finished at UNM in Albuquerque, so actually I'm in Albuquerque right now, and I'll be making my way trekking back to San Antonio to work on the next book.
Well, do you have a permanent place in San Antonio?
I have a storage unit.
Storage unit. Well, where do you stay when you live in San Antonio?
I have to find a new place to stay every time I go back. I don't know anyone that kind of lives like I do. I just kind of basically live out of a suitcase, and I go from city to city wherever I'm teaching. And if I have a book advance, then I go back to San Antonio and I find a new place and set up camp there for a couple of years.
So you consider San Antonio your home base?
I consider it my home base, even though, you know, I spend a lot of time out of state earning my living. And when I do sell a book or have a grant, I go back to Texas and live there.
That's a good compromise for you. As an American,
yeah,
you can go to San Antonio, which is probably the largest Mexican city.
That's right. It's the only city I've ever lived in where I'm not a minority.
Yeah, well, but you can have the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Your Americanism as well as your Mexican heritage.
Yeah,
that's right. City.
I'm glad you understand that, Don. You know, because you're from Texas, that is where Latin America starts, right there in San Antonio. And it's hard for me to explain to my relatives in Chicago why I'm living in Texas, because they can't fathom why we want to live there. That's what they call it, there. You know, but I love Texas now, and I really have found a place where both the English and the Spanish are at home with each other and are public. And that's very important, because in Chicago, even though we're there in big numbers, we Mexicans are there in big numbers, we're powerless. We're a community that we're not in positions of power. We're an invisible community, so to speak, politically, even though that is growing and changing since I left. But that's not the case in the Southwest. You know, I feel very much at home there. As a writer, it's important for me to hear the two languages I grew up with under my roof, the two languages that nurtured me as a child. So it's nice to finally come home, so to speak, to some place in the United States where I can walk the street and hear the names of people that are familiar to me, and go into a restaurant and hear someone say something half in English and half in Spanish. And
you are fluent in Spanish?
Yeah, well, I'm fluent in a domestic Spanish. You know, I couldn't go to say an interview like this and talk about my work in Spanish, because my Spanish is a domestic Spanish. Pass me this, bring me that. But, you know, I do enjoy living in San Antonio, where I'm hearing the mix of the two languages and I'm hearing how the two languages are sparking and stretching each other and growing in ways
that
I don't know.
The former mayor of San Antonio was
Henry Cisneros. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Unfortunate name. Well, I say unfortunate. He was actually a very bright star until that affair.
That's right. What a silly man. Yes, I know. Perhaps best that we don't go into Henry Cisneros. He's not a favorite topic of mine.
Well, I just got back from Texas. I grew up on Mexican food. And the last day I was there to visit my family, I went to a huge supermarket called Fiesta.
Oh, yes, I read about those.
Yeah. Big chain. Giant. Get any kind of food there. Vietnamese food,
that's right.
Cambodian. But what I... Even though I can get this material in New York, somehow I just felt that I had to get it there. And I came back with cans and cans of chilies. way down a shopping bag full of...
That's how we do it, too. And we're on planes. We're always taking tamales from one city to another. Tortillas, I know. I just had some matzo ball soup yesterday at a Jewish deli here. And, you know, I really love having Jewish food. And I look forward when I come to New York to get some good food. And the waiter said, how did you like it? And I was finishing it up. And I said, you know, it's very good, but it would be a lot better if I had a tortilla.
It's not as good as Mexican food, I can assure you.
Well, I don't know. I like the mix. I would love to have matzo ball soup with tortillas. And I like my friend who makes Polish sausage tacos. You know, I think that's nice when you do that mixing.
Well, it was very traumatic after I moved as a child, as we moved to Ohio from Texas. I had to enroll in the sixth grade in a school in Ohio.
And I bet you thought, you mean everybody doesn't eat tortillas?
Right. They never heard of it.
That's
there
right.
was no way to get Mexican food, not in the 1950s
no.
up north.
Mm-mm.
And even in New York in the early 1960s, when I started coming to New York on rare weekends, there was only one or two.
That's
Mexican
right. It's really changed. I think what to me is startling about being here this time is how many, not only Mexicanos that I'm seeing in the streets and working, delivering things and working in the delis and working, cleaning up restaurants. What I'm seeing also is a different kind of an indigenous face. A lot of Central Americans now. And I recognize them by their size and the features of their face.
Indian.
Yeah, very indigenous, very beautiful faces that are so striking. It looks like something from a pre-Columbian mask. I'm so amazed by the faces that I see walking down the streets here.
They have the flower concessions. You see them with shopping carts filled with flowers.
Yes, that's right.
And for some reason, they just started this business and... You see them everywhere, and they take subways. They go for miles on the subways with these shopping carts.
Yeah,
with fresh flowers.
I didn't know that. I've seen them. And that's something completely new since
it is new, within the last 2 years, 3 years.
That's right.
And to help service them, I live on the west side of Manhattan, up in the 90s. There are a whole bunch of new Mexican stores.
Really?
I mentioned I came back from Fiesta. I can get many of these same spices and things at some very, very ethnic Mexican stores where I go in and... I don't speak Spanish very well, just one or two words, and nobody speaks English at all. Mm-hmm. And a couple of coffee houses, and they're all Spanish, and they cater to Mexicans. I mean, but this is real Mexican
food. Real Mexican food, yeah.
Yeah, it's not the Tex-Mex that
no,
you see
right,
everywhere.
Right, yeah.
Well, let's get back to writing and,
okay.
And getting a little off the track a little bit.
Oh, but it's fun. When you go off the track, I always tell my students, we have to get off the track to get on the track. That's the way we do it.
I guess I think
the way I wrote my stories is that same route, Tom. I would go off the track when, and let a character say whatever he or she wanted to say. And later on, I'd have no idea where the story was going, but it usually led me to where I wanted to go.
Yes, as you begin to write and develop a character, something will happen that can bring something else to life. Isn't that true? And it's almost like building blocks.
That's right. And I think the thing I just had to do was shut off the thinking mind, the critical mind. I was telling my students, don't think so much when you're writing. You save the thinking for the revising. But feel. Mm. Feel. That's real important. And just follow things. And when you feel, you let things go where they want to go. And then when you're re-looking at it, rewriting and revising, then you can turn on the thinking part.
Tell me about your earliest published work.
Ooh, well, my earliest published work was when I was 23 and I was in graduate school and I was about 2 months away from finishing
my
formal education at the University of Iowa. Uh-huh. And it was a little poem called Mexican Hat Dance that a magazine, I don't know if it's even in print anymore, called Nuestro. It was the first, like, a big glossy magazine for Latinos in the U.S. It was kind of like the Brown Ebony, you know. And it was back in 1977, 78, something like that. That was my very first publication. And I was very silly. I signed some sort of contract. They published it, and they said they were going to pay me. They have never paid me to this day. So, but anyway, that was my first publication. I never got paid for it, and I'll never send them anything again, but that was it.
Well, for a little poem, they probably would have paid you $5 anyway.
Well, at that time, I needed the $5, though.
Well, I could use it now. You know, I wouldn't turn down $5 for this day.
Right.
But the House on Mango Street was the first book that you published.
Well, you know, Don, not really, because I published a little chapbook called Bad Boys back in 1980. And it was a little chapbook of six poems of mine from my graduate thesis. And it was published through the help of two Chicano writers, Lorna D. Cervantes and Gary Soto. Lorna D. had a press at that time, and she was doing a chapbook series, and Gary Soto funded it. So it was all a completely, you know, an effort from within the community.
Perhaps you better explain what a chapbook is.
A chapbook is a staple-bound book of, say, 6 to 12 pages, something very small that people can afford to buy for, say, $1 or $1.50. I think my book sold for $1.50. And it was created so that people, like, say, at poetry readings who heard your poem could say, oh, I like that poem, can I have a copy of it? And they could afford to buy it. So it was done through as a labor of love by the poet Lorna D. Cervantes. She's a California poet that has a book out with the University of Pittsburgh Press. And Gary Soto, who teaches at University of California, Berkeley. And they just kind of pulled their energy and money together and created a series of like about 12 books by young Chicano writers in the United States. And they published my first book. That's out of print now. But that's how a lot of us started, by publishing chapbooks where we would get paid in copies. You know, they'd pay us maybe 50 copies.
Well, the first big book, I hate to say big because it's really a small book.
A big little book.
It's now being published. The House on Mango Street is now just out, published by Vintage Books. But originally it was published in 1984.
By Arte Publico, right.
Yes.
Houston, by the way, just like you, from Houston.
That's a little tiny press.
It's actually not. It started as a tiny press. It's rather large now. It's what we call a small press, a not-for-profit press that comes out of the University of Houston. It originally was in the Midwest. It was founded by Nick Canelas, and he moved and took the press out to University of Houston, where it's still operating. And it's one of the largest Hispanic presses in the U.S. So they published my book originally. It's funny because, you know, that book was out and selling 30,000 copies and being used from Yale to Stanford. And it's only now that this book is out, coming out by way of New York, that some of the Texas presses are sitting up and taking notice, or some of the Texas media is interviewing me. And I think that's, you know, a real shame that Texans are that way, or Americans for that matter, that, you know, they don't look at work that's coming out of small presses or minority presses as valid until they come by way of New York.
Well, they're going to have to look at it as valid now. Vintage is a mainstream press.
That's right.
So this is the first mainstream publication, right?
That's right.
But you revised the book, I see.
Not really. By revise, we simply put it back the way I originally wrote it. Because when it originally came out from the small press, I never saw the final galleys, and there were some interpolations in the text that were made without my approval. So it's really restored, would be a better word instead of revised. It's restored to the way I originally wrote it. I'm a poet as well as a fiction writer, so I do things with fiction that most editors would look at as unorthodox. You know, I would write something, a line, for example, the last line of the book, where Esperanza says she's going to leave the neighborhood so that she could come back for those who cannot out. Now, that's a very unusual phrase, but as a poet, I felt liberty to say it that way. And the way that it was revised in the manuscript was they had added the verb get out, for those who cannot get out, which really bumps my ear. So it actually is restored to the way I originally wrote the text.
Well, much of your work, I think one of the reviewers said they were vignettes, but somebody else said they could be prose poems.
They call them all kinds of things. People don't know what to call them.
The House on Mangum Street, all of the vignettes are interrelated, but not so much Woman in Hollering Creek.
No. See, Mangum Street really was conceived as a book in which you could open the book at any one point and read one. And each story, whether it was a paragraph long or 3 pages long, would be complete all by itself, even if you didn't know anything about what had preceded or followed it. That was my plan. But I also had a design that if you read the book from left to right, from the beginning to the end, that there's another story going on. So I always had that design in my head that they would be interrelated and build to something. But that's not the case with Woman Hollering. They're a collection of short stories, all different kinds of stories, different kinds of characters.
Well, the most ambitious story in your new book, Woman Hollering Creek, is The Eyes of Zapata. Tell me about that.
Yes, that. Well, Don, that's the one that I'm the most proud of in the entire collection. And it's a real pity that I can't read that one in my tour, because it's my favorite. And I can't read it because it's so long, and there's no point in which I could cut it and get a sense of its movement. It's very circular. It's the story of Inés Alfaro, who is a real woman that was the common law wife of the Mexican revolutionary leader Emiliano Zapata. And, you know, I've always been very attracted to the figure of Emiliano Zapata. He's one of my heroes. I admire him a great deal. And that story really began out of my own obsession with Zapata. I started reading and buying books and studying Casasola photographs of his face. And the more I looked at him and the more I read, the more real he became and less a figure in history, I could see him, and I wanted to write a story from that point of view. So I thought I was going to write the story of one of his one-night brides, but the more I dug around in history, I found this name, Inés Alfaro. And of course, when you find women in history, they're usually just mentioned because they're someone's wife or someone's mother. And that was the case. She was his first common law wife, and she had two children that survived, at least two, perhaps more. That's all I could find out about her, and stray little details, that's it. So imagine how curious I became when I read about this woman that he had relations with before he married his legal wife, during the most critical times of the Mexican Revolution, and she gave birth to his child in 1915, which was a tremendous year for the Zapatistas. So he must have had ongoing relations with her during at least the first 5 years of the revolution, at least that is certain. And I became intrigued by who this woman could be. Who could she be? And that's how I guess the question that began in my head. And the more I did research, of course, I could find nothing about her. So I had to create her. And in order to create her, I wanted her to be the equal of the great general. And how could a woman who's indigenous be an equal if we consider her class? The only thing I could think to make her would be a witch woman. And that's what I made her.
Oh, it's a beautiful story. We're almost out of time, Sandra. Why don't you tell me the significance of the title of the book, Woman Hollering Creek?
Well, you know,
one of the stories.
It's one of the stories. It wouldn't have been my choice if I had named the collection what I wanted to. But, you know, this is the thing. If you're a Mexican woman in this country, or Mexican-American woman, as I am, we're not allowed to name things by a Spanish title. But if you're John Sayles, you can call your book Los Gusanos, and that's okay, you see? And my title, if I had named the book what I wanted it to be, it would have been Milagritos, Little Miracles. But you know, I'm a new writer, supposedly, to the mainstream scene, even though I've been writing and publishing for 13 years. Maybe the next book I'll get to name it what I want to, and I'll name it in Spanish. This title, Woman Hollering Creek, though, is the name of a real place in Texas, right in between Seguin and San Antonio. And when I did go to Texas, it was the first time in the tour that people came up to me and said, oh, are you going to tell us the story of how that creek got its real name? So people know the creek there. It's a real, real place on the planet. And this is a story in which I kind of turned the Mexican myth of La Llorona, the weeping woman, around and revised that myth so that it empowers women instead of restricts them.
Why don't we select an excerpt, maybe if you could read for a minute or so. We have a little, I have about a couple of minutes left to tape. I did admire 11 quite a bit.
Oh, that's a nice story, yeah.
But we'd have to read an excerpt from
there. Yeah. What would you like me to read, Don? What would you like to hear?
I love the Mexican movies. I love them. Really fun. Because it reminded me of Saturday morning fun show at the Village Theater in Houston.
That was so crazy. Yeah, I thought it was just unique to my culture, but everybody keeps coming up to me and saying, oh, no, that reminds me of the theater I used to go to.
Well, why don't you read 11? Why don't you read the first several paragraphs
okay.
of that?
All right. 11. What they don't understand about birthdays and what they never tell you is that when you're 11, you're also 10 and 9 and 8 and 7 and 6 and 5 and 4 and 3 and 2 and 1. And when you wake up on your 11th birthday, you expect to feel 11, but you don't. You open your eyes and everything's just like yesterday. Only it's today, and you don't feel 11 at all. You feel like you're still 10, and you are, underneath the year that makes you 11. Like some days you might say something stupid, and that's the part of you that's still 10. Or maybe some days you might need to sit on your mama's lap because you're scared, and that's the part of you that's 5. And maybe one day when you're all grown up, maybe you will need to cry like if you're 3. And that's okay. That's what I tell Mama when she's sad and needs to cry. Maybe she's feeling 3. Because the way you grow old is kind of like an onion, or like the rings inside a tree trunk, or like my little wooden dolls that fit one inside the other, each year inside the next one. That's how being 11 years old is.
Very, very nice. That's a very nice story. Sandra is really a pleasure having you here. I appreciate it, and I thought the books were...
Thank you.
Very, very nice.
Well, it's always fun talking to a fellow Texan. Thanks, Don.
Transplanted to Ohio, to Maryland, to Pennsylvania,
well,
now New York.
And I'm a Yankee Texan, so that makes us even.